On this episode of Skeptico.
Is memory stored in the brain?
No, I would say no. I'd say the whole idea of storage is a mistake here. It's a mistake to treat memories as kinds of things like they're objects.
How can science, neuroscience in this case, get this so wrong?
I wish I had a good answer to that. I mean, there's something really seductive about the idea that there has to be this trace left within us. Otherwise, it looks like magic.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on today's episode, we have the great pleasure of welcoming Dr. Stephen Browdy to Skeptico. Back to Skeptico, actually, but the first time, I didn't get a chance to talk to him, so it was really a great pleasure for me to talk to someone who has made such a great contribution to the field of parapsychology, and I guess I would just say clear-thinking science in general. There were so many topics I wanted to cover with Dr. Browdy that it was actually hard to pin down and choose where to go, but as you'll see in this conversation that kind of meanders from here to there, I think we talked about a number of interesting points. At least I hope you find them of some value. Let's get right to it. Here's my dialogue with Dr. Stephen Browdy. Today we welcome Dr. Stephen Browdy to Skeptico. Dr. Browdy is the former chairman of the philosophy department at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He's also past president of the Parapsychology Association and is currently the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Scientific Exploration, a fantastic journal where top-notch scientists exchange research and ideas that they really aren't supposed to talk about. This is a journal we've talked about many times on this show. I am extremely impressed that, Steve, you are the editor-in-chief of that, one, for the great service that you do in keeping that journal going, but also the knowledge you must have to kind of handle the broad range of topics that you all cover there is super, super impressive to me. So first, I just want to say hats off and thank you for doing that fine work.
Well, thank you, but let's not overestimate my knowledge. I mean, I have a terrific team of associate editors who help me, because no one person can really competently cover all the areas that the JSE deals with.
Yeah, but you have kind of a unique ability to kind of see the big picture, and you have a certain intellectual toughness that I think is really important for that job. So I commend you on that. Let me also mention to folks that Steve is the author of several great books, including one that we're going to talk a lot about today because it pulls together many of the ideas he's been working on over the years. That would be Crimes of Reason on Mind, Nature, and the Paranormal. So with that, we're just chatting a little bit that welcome back to Skeptico, but this is really the first time you and I have had a chance to talk, so it's a special delight for me to have you on.
Well, thank you. It's nice to meet you at last.
Super. So there are a lot of topics we could talk about. As I was mentioning, you've really amassed quite a bit of work, research, and insights into these topics that we talk a lot about so much on Skeptico, about consciousness, about fringe science, if you will, that maybe shouldn't be fringe science, but is considered fringe science. And I think that the hard part for me in where to dig into this is, you know, do you go for the inside baseball kind of stuff that only a few people are going to care about and be interested in? Or do you take the big picture stuff that has its own problems? And I choose to take the big picture stuff for a couple reasons. And one is that I feel like sometimes researchers like yourself and the people who follow your research like me can sometimes have a tendency to bury the lead when it comes to some of the work and some of the discoveries that you're making. And let me use that as a lead into the first topic I want to talk about, the first example. You know, what really brought this home to me was a brief quote from a paper you wrote some time ago but which you cover more extensively in your book, Crimes of Reason, and it has to do with memory. You wrote, "The concept of memory trace is not simply useless, but actually incoherent." Now, I love that. That's a classic Dr. Stephen Browdy kind of quote. I like how you just lay it out there and are very direct. But let me just be clear before you comment on that and before we kind of dig into infinite regress and all that, which we want to kind of talk about to support what you're saying. I want to be clear about what you're saying. You're saying that the commonly accepted truism in modern neuroscience that memories are stored in your brain, you're saying that that is an incoherent, a stupid idea that you can logically break down and prove to be false in a matter of minutes. So I guess we should start by digging into that and telling us why. At first, what memory trace is, make sure I'm getting that right, because it really boils down to the idea that memories are stored in the brain in simplistic terms, and why that's a useless and actually incoherent idea. Can we start there?
Sure, but let me correct one thing right at the beginning. I wouldn't say it's a stupid idea. To say that a scientific or an ostensible scientific concept is nonsense or incoherent doesn't mean it's stupid. I mean, nonsense, to say it's nonsense just means that it makes no sense. And while there's no shortage of stupidity in the world, there's another kind of nonsense, and that's what we're dealing with here. I call it deep nonsense.
Great, great. Important distinction. Love it.
Deep nonsense is a very easy kind of nonsense to fall into. We can do it by using obscurantist terms, by failing to understand the assumptions on which our reasoning is based. The kind of deep nonsense that I think afflicts memory trace theory actually goes back as far as Plato. And it involves a certain kind of essentialist thinking, but we can get into that as we go on. The notion of a memory trace is supposed to explain how it's even possible to have memories. So I remember my high school graduation. Now, how is that possible? Memory trace theory would have it that my graduation left some sort of permanent physical or at least temporary physical modification in me, presumably in my brain, that closes the temporal gap between my high school graduation and now, when I'm ostensibly remembering my high school graduation. Otherwise, if there isn't some permanent record in me of my high school graduation, it seems like magic that I could remember something that happened so many years ago.
So, right, right. And let's just add to that. So, because one of the things that's difficult to talk, one of the reasons it's difficult to talk about this stuff is this is so ingrained in our quote unquote education, if you will, that this is it. So we see pictures of fMRIs. We see all sorts of great research being done, sleep research, EEGs, all this stuff. And it all boils back to this, you are a biological robot kind of thing. You are like a computer. We know how computers work. It's stored in your brain. I mean, that is a given assumption. And what you're saying is that because we're so tied to this idea that there has to be a physical component to it and that everything we experience is tied to our brain, that's our first way that we're deceived. Am I getting that right?
Yes. This is one of the hardest issues of all time, I think, to come to grips with. And I've frankly had to work on it a long time myself to disabuse myself of this particular notion. And there are all sorts of ways of diving into it. Let me take the big picture, since you like the big picture. One way of getting at this is that there are certain kinds of assumptions being made in mechanistic science. And one of them is something I call the small is beautiful assumption. And this is the idea that, and part of this idea, let me just begin by saying, is perfectly sensible. Most scientists would agree that explaining a phenomenon in terms of lower level processes is something, we call that an analytical explanation. We explain how something occurs by referring to things that happen at a lower level. So we explain heat, for example, as molecular motion. Now, most scientists would agree that that kind of explanation by analysis, that sort of vertical explanation, can't go on indefinitely. That sooner or later, we have to come to some ground level primitive phenomena, some fundamental phenomena. And at that point, it no longer makes sense to ask how those phenomena occur. At that level of scientific description, that's simply the way the universe works, and nothing at a lower level explains how or why. Those are just fundamental regularities, fundamental facts about nature. Now, I actually think that part is okay. I believe there have to be primitive phenomena, the phenomena that cannot be further explicated by looking at a lower level, where I think many scientists make an error is by saying that wherever these primitive phenomena are, they always have to be at the level of the very small, you know, the chemical, the biochemical, the neurological, the atomic, the subatomic level, and never at the observable level, for example, at the level of behavior. And one of the things I want to say and go into in Crimes of Reason in many different ways is that there are primitive phenomena in the domain of psychology, in the domain of behavior, and there are certain important patterns in nature that emerge first and only at the level of behavior and that have no explanation at a lower level. They may be mediated by things that go on at a lower level, but they can't be explained in terms of things that go on at a lower level. Meaning is another one of them.
Well, yeah, meaning is a big one, but I'm kind of losing you there a little bit as it relates to memory, because where I thought we're going with memory is this kind of problem with the infinite regress. I mean, so your memory, if we go down the path and say, okay, your high school memory is stored in your brain and we can go stimulate your brain in certain places and then you have that memory, so that's where it must be, then we have the problem of saying, okay, where is your memory of that memory stored? And then if we say, okay, well, that's where that is, then we say, well, where is the memory of your memory of your memory stored? And then we can keep going that way in an infinite fashion that it kind of makes the whole thing logically seem kind of incoherent.
Well, these are two sides of the same coin. What I would want to say is that the ability to remember is one of those things that has no lower level explanation. But you're right that another way to get at this is to look at the logical problems in trying to attribute memory to permanent records of past events, for example, stored somehow in the brain. So let me use my favorite example. Suppose we want to remember who attended the party we gave last night. So we ask every party guest to leave behind a trace of their having been at the party. And suppose each guest from the party leaves behind a tennis ball. Now, clearly, the tennis ball, as a trace of their being there, is not going to be adequate for me to recall who actually attended the party. What we need is something more specific and linked to the particular guest. We need some kind of unambiguous calling card, representational calling card, something that leads me directly from the trace to the person who left the trace. And a tennis ball isn't specific enough to do that.
So you ask them to sign the tennis ball. So now you have the trace, which is the tennis ball, and you have the signature that ties them to the tennis ball. Problem solved, right?
No, because there's no way to be sure that the person who left the signature is the person whose signature it is. The same, it could be the same if somebody left a photograph of themselves.
And there's also the problem of you're then assuming or presupposing some kind of system for decoding the signature, right? Which would then be tied to all the same kind of infinite regress kind of things that go on.
So the problem with traces right off the bat is that either you're faced with a regress, or if you want to stop the regress, you have to suppose that there's some kind of intrinsic relationship of similarity or isomorphism between the trace left in you and the thing that left the trace. And that relies on this alleged relation of intrinsic similarity, which actually makes no sense. Two things are not intrinsically similar or dissimilar.
Well, it almost, you get down to the, you know, give me one miracle and I can solve the rest kind of thing. Really, that's what it kind of amounts to, right? Is like, we can't solve it, so give me this and then I can start. And that's probably the problem with consciousness, right? I mean, that's where people are with consciousness. They say, okay, all the mechanistic, reductionistic ideas of consciousness boil down to, at least in the modern phase, now that we've gotten past the consciousness is an illusion silliness and we're now in the quantum mind stuff, it's like no one wants to deal with how that stuff happens. I think one of the things I wanted to get into, that was a little bit of a digression, and I apologize for that, because one of the things that this gets into, this idea of memory, it gets into two things. One is it explodes our current accepted wisdom about not only neuroscience and memory, but about consciousness. And it also kind of points to some of the bigger problems in science that you point out to and that you've experienced in your career and that go against what we generally accept about the idea that science is progressing, science is moving, science is constantly testing its paradigms. And I mean, what I feel like you're saying in a way is the emperor has no clothes here, because when we reduce memory to being what you kind of say it is, I think a lot of other things crumble, like neuroscience crumbles, and then it calls into question what parapsychology is called into question, is how do we even know any of the stuff we think we know in science, given our inability to, one, measure things, and our inability to really properly understand things that fit all under this category of consciousness, and just about everything fits under this category of consciousness. I might have given you too much to pull apart there, but see if you can help me untangle my mess.
Well, you did touch on a lot of things, but one of them was one of the reasons I brought up the small is beautiful assumption, because there are some serious methodological issues that need to be addressed here. And one has to do with something as Sherry Turkle called physics envy. And the small is beautiful assumption is one manifestation of that. The idea being that we have to break down observable regularities in terms of lower level components. Something connected with that is another methodological issue, and that is a certain way of proceeding from examples when we're dealing with consciousness. A common mistake, for example, in the philosophy of language, let me just give an analogy, is to suppose that if we want to understand how language works, how meaningful sentences are constructed, and how people understand one another and communicate, is if we want to understand language, we have to begin with simple sentences like "the cat is on the mat." And the assumption here is that we're dealing with, in simple sentences, we're dealing with examples that are close to a theoretical ideal, and that more complex and ambiguous utterances are just degenerate examples of the simple cases. So we start from the simple cases, as we do in mathematics and certain other axiomatic sciences, and then we go on to more complex examples from that. And that we analyze the complex examples, the degenerate complex examples, in terms of the simple ones. I like to turn that on its head. It seems to me that in psychology, in the area of discussing consciousness, in the behavioral sciences generally, it's the complex examples that are the ones that are closest to the theoretical ideal, that are the most illuminating. The simple ones are actually the degenerate and misleading ones, because they abstract out most of what's interesting about the complex ones. So if you want to understand how meaning works, you don't look at a sentence like "the cat is on the mat." That leads to abominations like the idea that there has to be a kind of correspondence between the elements of the sentence and the elements, corresponding elements in the world. A more illuminating kind of remark to tell us how meaning works is Oscar Wilde's comment, "I'm dying beyond my means." The only way to understand that is to understand a great deal about life, to understand about cliches and so on, and to understand how a sentence functions in a particular context against an entire background of human history and assumptions and relationships. Does that help?
I think it partially helps, but maybe we've kind of pulled things in a whole different direction. Let's go back to memory trace for a minute, because I want to make sure that I properly characterize what you're saying. So if at the end of the day, the idea of memories being stored in the brain is incoherent, logically incomplete, what does that say about neuroscience? I made some assertions about what I think it means about neuroscience, because I've spent a good deal of time kind of battling this neuroscience nincompoopery and the reductionistic mind equals brain stuff, but maybe we're saying something different. What do you think that says about neuroscience's understanding of memory?
Well, if memory can't be explained in terms of traces left behind in the brain or some other physical location.
Is memory stored in the brain?
Well, I think the problem, no, I would say no. I'd say the whole idea of storage is a mistake here. It's a mistake to treat memories as kinds of things like they're objects. I think it's still acceptable to say that the expression of memory is something mediated by neurophysiological processes. But to say it's mediated by it doesn't mean to say it's explained in terms of it.
Explain what you mean when you say mediated. And explain why that explains those really cool fMRI pictures we see on the news, on the science news sites.
Well, to express memory, we need a functioning organism. So, you know, you can impair the organism, you can destroy the physiological integrity of the organism, and you can affect the ability to exhibit memory behavior. But it doesn't follow that memories are stored from that. I mean, it's one thing to say that we need a functioning organism to remember. And it's another thing to say that there was an actual trace or an ability to remember, a mechanism for remembering in the human organism.
How can science, neuroscience in this case, how can science get this so wrong?
I wish I had a good answer to that. I mean, there's something really seductive about the idea that there has to be this trace left within us. Otherwise, it looks like magic that we've got this kind of causation over a temporal gap.
It does, and it is. I mean, let's use that word magic to kind of segue into your long history in of exploration and research into parapsychology. I mean, what is really at stake, it seems to me, is a quote-unquote scientific worldview giving way to a magical quote-unquote worldview. And I think I've heard you make the case, and I've had some other folks on the show that have made the case, that if we're really going to be honest, we have to opt for the magical worldview. From our perspective, where we sit, if we're just going to kind of pick one or the other, given how little we understand, the further we dig into how things work, the magical worldview seems, in the way that that word is thrown around, is a better fit for what we're observing than this quote-unquote mechanistic, scientific, reductionistic worldview. What do you think about that?
There are two things going on here. One is a plea I would make over and over for a kind of methodological pluralism in science. That is that, as Aristotle recognized a long time ago, different domains of investigation require different methodologies, different kinds of explanation, different modes of explanation, different assumptions. As far as the particularly magical worldview is concerned, there we're using magic maybe in a different sense. And my favorite example has usually to do with psychokinesis. So suppose I can move a compass needle a millimeter or just by thinking about it. It's a very small step from doing that to making somebody drop dead by thought alone. So the existence of any psychokinesis at all, even if it seems to be minimal, forces us to take seriously this kind of worldview that we usually associate, and usually condescendingly, only with so-called primitive cultures. It's a worldview in which thoughts can have all sorts of malevolent or lethal consequences, and in which we'd have to take responsibility for a range of occurrences we'd just as soon be bystanders for.
Well, it really collides with culture in a couple ways. It collides with culture in the way that you're talking about, which really challenges our religious traditions and our spiritual traditions, which we've kind of set over on the side, but are still so much as part of what people believe in, are kind of caught up in understanding in a way to understand their world. But it also clashes with our scientific worldview, because in the same way that you're saying, if I can move the compass needle 1 millimeter, if I can collapse the wave function, it really calls into question science in general, because now I can no longer really measure. Everything I measure, every experiment has to have an asterisk that says, We did it the best we could, but we really couldn't nail down this thing called consciousness over here. So all these results are tentative. I mean, isn't that really the case?
Well, that's part of it, too. There is this Pandora's box that we open as soon as we allow mind to directly influence physical world without the usual sorts of intermediary causal chains that we like to suppose exist. So if there can be a direct causal connection between states of my mind and remote physical states of affairs without these intervening causal chains, or even if I can raise welts on my skin hypnotically.
Which proven over and over again. I mean, that's a simple thing, right?
Right. And we don't understand how any of that works. So we don't really know what exactly is going on, even in conventional science. So one of the reasons I think there's such deep resistance to any scientific investigation of psychokinesis is because if we take that seriously, we might have to wonder quite seriously about centuries of conventional scientific experiments. If a person's unconscious desires can influence random event generators, for example, who knows what the highly motivated intentions of scientists over the centuries have, what the relationship between those motivated intentions were and the results of their experiments were.
Right. One of the things I think we kind of keep dancing around is science, in its effort to kind of keep order and keep things, keep the trains running on time, chooses to ignore all this stuff. It's back to the shut up and calculate kind of thing that the quantum physicists finally came around to. And does that lead to, and this is a leading question, I think, for me, because I think it obviously, to me, does lead to some of the nincompoopery we see with science in terms of the corruption of science and also just the inability for science to get out from itself. You know, we see these news items that the majority of psychological experiments cannot be reproduced. We see it's really not that much better in physics, where we can't reproduce results. We have the decline effect, where even the results that were good, that were replicated over time, when we go back to replicate them 10 years later, sometimes we can't reproduce them, which all we can come up with all sorts of reasons for that. But we're at the end of the day, we would lose a lot of confidence in science if we were to fully kind of step back and look at this. And at the same time, we're don't want to give up our iPhones because our iPhones work. So how do we look at science, and how do we look at science's ability to really move us forward in two dimensions? The one dimension that I think we're all comfortable with is from an engineering angle, we think science can make progress and we can measure it.
And it does. Our iPhones work.
Our iPhones work. And from a meaning angle, I think we're a lot less confident. And most of us have, in a way, given up on the idea that science is really going to move us towards greater meaning, greater understanding of who we are and what our world is really all about. Do you have a comment on that?
Well, I mean, I think when you take a sufficient bird's eye view and look at the history of science, it has moved us forward in lots of ways. That doesn't mean it's moving in a straight line. I believe that science can get off track from time to time, that it can. But I think when you look at human progress, it looks like we have evolved. We have progressed. We do understand more than we did before.
What do you think about when you say that? What are your thoughts about what we really understand more?
Well, we certainly understand more in the sense that we've gained increasing control over our environment and can produce such things as iPhones and make better and better equipment.
Right. And other people counter that and saying, you know, shamanistic cultures living in the Andes had a better, deeper understanding of the true connection they had with their environment, and that what we've done is create this out of control system that seems to be headed towards destroying our environment completely. So, you know, you've heard all those arguments. I mean, do we have this illusion of progress when we're really declining at a rate that's kind of pretty scary in a lot of respects?
Well, I'd say mechanistic science has its virtues, but the mistake is to suppose that it has to be the complete picture. The shaman might have some insights as well, and they can coexist, it seems to me.
Yeah, that's the problem I guess I have is how they coexist. Let me switch gears for a minute before we run out of time, and I apologize for kind of being all over the place here, but I just feel like we could talk about a lot of these things for a long time, and I don't have a clear agenda on where I'm going. So let me do a typical kind of more skeptico thing where I can tell you where we maybe have a point of difference, and maybe that'll help highlight where you're coming from and where I'm coming from. I love your skeptical approach to all things, really, you seem to have. But in particular, you're not afraid to call to task parapsychology when it looks a little bit too much like it's getting off course in the same way that mechanistic science can get off course.
But let's not forget that I believe in the evil eye.
Yeah, and that's the part that I think really kind of challenges a lot of people that from mainstream science that try and talk to you, is that you're very accommodating of kind of both sides, and you're willing to kind of to come over to this side and take that position and then switch over and take the other position, which I think is the only way to be. I mean, if we accept the data and accept that we know very little, and the more we know we don't know, then that's the only appropriate place to take. So let's dive into one of those. Survival. Survival of consciousness is a topic that you've been willing to stick your neck out and take kind of a contrarian position. For example, near-death experience, you think is not convincing enough of survival of consciousness, nor is mediumship, nor is any of the other research that's out there. Tell me why you think the burden of proof, I guess, would be my first question. Why do you think the burden of proof for survival of consciousness is so high in your mind, given that I'd flip around to the other side and say, you know, if we're really going to say, okay, we really don't know what we're talking about when it comes to consciousness. We don't know when it begins. We don't know when it ends. We don't know what's necessary and sufficient to cause it. We're really in the dark about consciousness. So if we look at the natural history of consciousness, throughout time, almost every culture has come to the conclusion that consciousness survives bodily death, and we have some connection to our ancestors. That's the data. And then if we look at the current data, we have after-death communication, spontaneous after-death communication, induced after-death communication, assisted after-death communication, all point in the same direction. So why, in your mind, is the burden of proof on survival of consciousness still so high and not achieved despite all that data, if you will?
Because those various sources of evidence, although can point in the direction that you mentioned, can also point in some other directions, which I think proponents of the survivalist hypothesis haven't taken sufficiently seriously. And the main one is the living agent psi hypothesis, the idea that it's the capacities, the psychic capacities of living human beings that simulate evidence for survival. And there are really two sources of trouble. One has to do with a whole bunch of aspects of normal human functioning, or better than normal human functioning, that advocates of survival don't take seriously. We don't really understand what human abilities are. We don't understand what's going on in cases of prodigies, savants, or even just the latent human capacities that are elicited in good dissociative states, you know, in cases of multiple personality or in cases of hypnosis, where under hypnotic regression, people behave in very, very creative ways and display dramatic creativity that they might not have been capable of displaying otherwise. So we know, for example, in cases of hypnotic regression, that people have not been genuinely regressed. Martin Oren, a number of years ago, did some very interesting experiments in regression. He hypnotized one person and ostensibly regressed them to the age of 6, and then asked them to write down the sentences that he uttered. And the person wrote in very childlike handwriting, but correctly spelled all the polysyllabic words that no 6-year-old would know. So what we're getting there is dramatic creativity that was elicited in a hypnotic state. And unless we start taking that kind of stuff seriously, we really don't know what's going on in cases that seem to suggest survival.
Okay, but if we do take it seriously, we still don't know what's going on. I mean, we really don't.
That's exactly right. There's too much that hasn't been looked at sufficiently carefully. And one of the frustrating things about trying to mount a scientific case for survival, and this is the conclusion I reluctantly came to when I wrote Immortal Remains, is that it's really hard to decide where the scales are tilting in the direction of survival. It depends on what day you ask me which way I think it's going to go. I think there's some very emotionally compelling cases, absolutely. But if you really want to say, have we ruled out the viable competitor hypotheses, I'd say we haven't conclusively done that. We don't have a slam dunk case of survival that makes it really irrational to opt for anything else.
Right. But how would we ever, given that when we move away from a reductionistic, mechanistic view of consciousness, then we introduce all these problems in understanding any of this data. So the problem I guess I have with your position is, what's the path forward? You've done a great job of exploring all the problems that parapsychology has in moving forward. And just to kind of briefly say, you know, how do you do prayer research when everyone's praying for everybody all the time? It's a classic control problem that can't be controlled. And I'd say the same thing is true here with survival. I mean, one of the anecdotally, what we hear from survival is that we are living out the dream that somehow our reality is in fact less than real. So how can we expect to really nudge closer to that kind of truth, given that we're playing over here in the sandbox and aren't allowed on the big field of consciousness that might be out there?
Maybe it helps to be a philosopher here, because the solution may be to learn to shrug and live with it, you know, that there may be some mysteries that we're just not going to settle satisfactorily in the way that we'd like. I mean, I felt I learned a lot in writing Immortal Remains, but what I learned to my surprise was really how interesting living human beings are and how there are various aspects of human creativity, latent human capacities, and seemingly miraculous abilities of living human beings that we haven't fully appreciated, that we still have a lot of work to do before we can perhaps make some genuine progress. We don't understand what human abilities are. We don't understand what's going on with prodigious abilities. We don't understand how somebody like Mozart could have achieved what he achieved. We don't understand Gauss's extraordinary and early mathematical abilities. We don't understand how idiots, so-called idiot savants, can exhibit the remarkable abilities they have at the same time as possessing deficits, which you would ordinarily think would rule out the possibility of those abilities.
Granted, and I think it's a good point, we also don't understand any of the spiritual stuff.
Right.
If you'll allow me just to say spiritual stuff, but how do we interface with that as well? Because I sometimes feel like, you know, I hear what you're saying in terms of extended human capabilities that we choose not to explore because they don't fit into the box. But if we look at a lot of those extended experiences with consciousness, they don't come back and talk about that. They don't come back and talk about telepathic abilities or psychokinetic abilities. What they come back and talk about is God and love and connection and all this stuff that sounds very spiritual. And we seem very inclined to kind of sidestep all that. I mean, that's the other thing that the near-death experience research does, is they'll give you statistics out the yazoo on every way of cutting and slicing and dicing that, but they don't want to approach the larger meaning questions. How do we move forward in addressing the spiritual dimension of this stuff? How can we, is there a path forward from your philosopher scientific perspective on how we can probe that?
I'm not really sure, to be perfectly honest. That there does seem to be that kind of dimension to many of these experiences is absolutely without question. And I believe it's something that needs to be taken seriously, whether we explain it in terms of what happens under certain traumatic physiological experiences, whether it's just a natural response to that, but not genuinely spiritual. remains an open question. It may be the sort of thing that we can answer only when we get there ourselves. And that's not the answer you probably want to hear, but that may be the only answer there is.
Well, I guess I have to push that a little bit further. I mean, that may be the only answer there is, but since we're exploring how we might push forward in these other areas, speculate for a minute in how we might push forward in doing, in probing that scientifically. How do we try and nudge a little bit closer along that dimension? Because I my sense in looking at this stuff for a number of years is that that's the dimension. That's the dimension that we really have to try and advance. And I guess I'd also add in there that I don't think it's as impenetrable as we sometimes lay out. It's just messy. I mean, it's just really messy. You have, like you alluded to before, you know, about the malevolent aspect to it. You know, what do we do with demonic stuff? Well, you got to kind of throw it into the mix. You got to throw that on the table too, and voodoo and witchcraft. But then you also have to throw in ecstatic spiritual experiences and kundalini experiences and Christian experiences and all that. But I don't think we can just kind of ignore it all and say, well, we can't handle that.
No, I don't recommend that we ignore it all. I mean, one of the things I admire so much about William James was that he took all of this stuff seriously and recognized that these are all data points that need to be thrown into the mix. And so I'm not recommending that we ignore any of this.
No, I didn't mean to suggest that you were saying that, but more what I was trying to get at, Steve, is what do you think? What does your intuition say in terms of how we might move along that dimension? Because you've explored it personally a great deal. I mean, you've gotten into that stuff.
Trouble with exploring some of this stuff in a scientifically acceptable way is that we can't really do it with IRBs. I mean, you can't have control groups in near-death research.
Yeah, but as you alluded to before, I mean, maybe we need to throw all that bullshit out the window anyway, because so much of it is that. It just isn't real. I mean, like I said, you know, it's now coming out. I mean, none of that psychology stuff really replicates very well. None of that stuff is really that reliable. So different methodologies is what you said. Different methodologies for different problems. I mean,
well, the answer might be something like Charlie Tart's state-specific scientific investigation. Maybe that you actually have to be in the state to properly investigate it. And that creates problems, too. I mean, you don't want to induce near-death states in order to probe it. And once you start dealing with near-death states, there's the problem of time stamping. You know, how can you be sure that the information you're getting really occurred during the states of genuine physiological death? And in fact, I don't think you've got genuine physiological death, because all these people are resuscitated. So there are lots of points of unclarity here, and I'm not sure how to work past that.
Okay. Tell folks what else they're going to find in Crimes of Reason, and what other projects you're working on now as you're kicking back in Las Vegas and figuring out a system for beating the slots.
Well, Crimes of Reason just deals with a bunch of themes that I've written about over the years, and the different essays in Crimes of Reason bring together various of these threads, which I hadn't really brought together before. One is the defects of mechanistic science, one of which is how to properly engage in psychological explanation rather than explaining a person's behavior in terms of the emitting of behavior from internal states. I think there is something else that we really have to mean by explaining behavior. And so I go into that in some detail. I look at how mechanistic theorizing has polluted other areas of interest, like Rupert Sheldrake's theory of morphogenesis.
Yeah, you're kind of hard on Rupert. And in a good way, I guess, to kind of call to task, you know, that stuff. But I kind of felt similarly to the way I felt about the near-death experience research, is like, gee, can't we big picture step back and go, wow, they've really advanced the ball forward here in some important ways. Same with mediumistic research, you know. Hey, they've really advanced the ball forward just by breaking the spell of materialism. shouldn't we give them a little bit more flack to kind of get their feet underneath them and run a little bit?
I think I do give credit for that. I mean, I think mediumistic research gives us a great amount of data that we need to take seriously, whether and which will test both the living agents eye hypothesis and the survival hypothesis. I think Rupert deserves credit for calling our attention to various regularities that may have not been appreciated sufficiently before. All I was attacking was his explanation of those regularities. What I would say is that the regularities may be primitive and not explainable in the mechanistic way he tried to do it. His analysis of morphogenesis was just standard mechanistic stuff.
Right. I mean, maybe that's because that's where he's coming from, you know, yeah. I mean, trained in that way. But it's also this kind of middle ground, isn't it? I mean, it's a middle ground to bridge people from, and I don't think he thinks of it that way, but that's always as I saw it. I didn't take it quite as literally as he kind of scopes it out, but I also saw it as a broader movement towards, hey, there does seem to be some kind of pattern overlay that is in play here in a way that we don't understand, kind of thing.
Absolutely. I think he's right about that. And that's what I think he deserves credit for. It's the actual carrying out of the explanatory strategy that I objected to.
Well, that's the problem. I mean, you do an awesome job as a critic and a skeptic, and an important job, because your criticisms and your skepticism is very pointed and very logical in a way that I think brings these things bare. But by the same token, it doesn't really lead us towards a complete explanation of how we would move things forward. So like in Rupert's case, we have the phenomena that he's observed and he's trying to explain. And you got to have a certain, you can appreciate this, gosh, more than anyone probably, you know, being in the JSE head chair there, but maybe that's what makes your role there a good one, is that everyone pushes for the final answer. I think, so maybe Sheldrick overreached in trying to give the final, instead of just saying, okay, here's how the landscape works. We might want to move in this direction of being these kind of pattern overlays. I don't have a clue for how that works. Well, that doesn't make for anything that's really going to get you published either. So any thoughts on that dilemma?
Yeah, well, look, first of all, I know what my abilities are to some extent. I know I'm pretty good at this critical activity that I engage in. And I don't particularly feel that I have gifts in theory construction as much as I do in theory destruction. But, you know, I'd like to think that I play an important role in the overall ecology of this. So some people think that theorizing is as easy as lying. And I think theorizing is actually very difficult. And
because people like you are out there, right? I mean, you have to make it difficult. I mean, really, that's right. You know.
Well, so, you know, I like to think I'm playing a valuable role in the process, but I may not be the person to push forward. I think it's actually very difficult to push forward and to do so successfully. So I'm content with that role. And
that's awesome.
I'd like to think it's done some good.
I definitely think it has. So, Steve, what are you up to? What are you up to nowadays? I know you stay busy, but any new major projects in terms of books or anything like that?
No books at the moment, but I've been pursuing various cases of ostensible psychokinesis. I did some more work with the Felix Experimental Group in Germany last fall. In December, I was in Argentina checking out a subject who apparently can raise tables just by touching them very lightly on top.
Getting all the way back to your first initial experience that launched exactly. You in this direction. How interesting that is.
I love watching psychokinesis in action.
What do you think? What is it about psychokinesis that really pulls you in? Because it does seem to, if I'm maybe I'm reading something in there that isn't there, but it does seem to engage you in a way different than some of the other aspects of this strangeness and paranormal stuff.
Well, in some ways, it's easier to document than other forms of psychic functioning, and more dramatic to document than other forms of psychic functioning. And as
it interfaces with the mechanistic kind of world that I think you're interested in merging with a little bit. You know, I mean, I think in the same way that you're knocking it down, I think you do have a certain respect for what physicists were trying to do and what scientists are trying to do with their mechanistic models. Is that fair?
Well, I do have a respect for that, but I would say in my case, it has more to do with my role as spokesperson for the dark side. You know, there's a certain amount of naivete in the parapsychological community that we've got these abilities as if they can be used only for the good. But I don't know of anything that can be used exclusively for the good. And so I really want to look at the big picture here when it comes to the extent of our influence on the world around us. And that's why I've suggested so often that if we really want to understand the role of psi in life, we need to look at people who are remarkably lucky or unlucky. And I like looking at unlucky people because I think they're really, really fascinating.
You know, I'm trying to wrap this thing up, but we keep touching on issues that I can't let go. And, you know, the good and the bad. I mean, there we go again. I mean, we're back in the domain of the spiritual. And right. What do you make of that? What is the good and the bad? What's your best guess on what that playing field, what that terrain is like?
Well,
is there a hierarchical order to consciousness? To me, that seems inescapable from the data. The data is that there is some hierarchical structure. There is good and bad. And as soon as we put it on that dimension, we got God, because at the top of the pyramid is the ultimate good.
I'm not sure I'm ready to follow you there. I mean, my interest has been trying to get some sense of what the natural history of psi is, because until we understand what role psychic functioning is playing in life, what its natural domain of expression is, we have no idea what it is we're trying to bring into the lab. I mean, we can study memory in laboratory situations because we have some idea what memory is doing in real life situations, but we don't know what ordinary psychic functioning is like, whether it's like athletic abilities that can only be studied in real life contexts. And until we have a real grip on what psi's natural history is, until we have some idea what role it's playing in everyday affairs, you know, whether it's messing with traffic lights or exacerbating a despised colleague's arthritis or just hiding our socks, you know, we have no idea.
Fair enough. But I got to pull you back to that good or bad, because you're the one who brought it up, right? So there's good and bad, and we recognize it as such. You know, we can try and pull it apart and all the rest of that, but we recognize it as good and bad. How does that not suggest a hierarchical order of consciousness? We've just laid out those dimensions, and there doesn't at one end of that spectrum, however we're going to describe that, we wind up describing something. I'm not a religious person in the least, but we wind up describing something that religious traditions throughout time have described as something like God. That to me seems inescapable, but not to you.
No, I mean, I wouldn't opt here for full-fledged ethical relativity, but what we regard as good or bad may just be relativized to our limited perspectives on what's needed at the moment. You know, sometimes good things are painful. Surgery sometimes might be necessary.
Genocide. I mean, torture, kidnapping. You know, all the really bad stuff. You know, I mean, I think we have a pretty easy time saying, you know, that's bad.
Well, that's why I'm not opting for full-fledged ethical relativity. I think there are some things that are genuinely bad. Can we all agree on what those are? That's a tough one. Does that actually lead to God, or does it lead to, boy, what do I want to say about that?
that's really the question. What do you want to say? I just am interested in what you really think.
You know, one of the reasons I write books is that I'm not satisfied with my opinions on virtually anything until I've been able to work through it in a way that makes me feel that I've really come to grips with all the nuances of the issues.
There you go. There you go. There's the next book.
Maybe. My next book actually is going to be a book on suppositories. It's called Up Yours, An Illustrated History of Suppositories.
Well, that's one we'll certainly have to wait for. I tell you what, I hope you're okay with this kind of rambling dialogue we've had. I've certainly enjoyed it. It's been a great, great pleasure. And I congratulate you on your ongoing work. It's not like any of it's ending. Our guest, of course, has been Dr. Stephen Browdy. His books are many. You can find them on Amazon. We talked a lot about Crimes of Reason on Mind, Nature, and the Paranormal. Steve, best of luck. Thanks again for joining me.
Thank you very much, Alex. I appreciate it, and I hope you don't mind my rambling.
Thanks again to Dr. Stephen Browdy for joining me today on Skeptico. I guess the one obvious question to tee up from this interview is, do you think the idea of memory being stored in the brain, which of course is fundamental to modern neuroscience, do you think that is logically inconsistent? As philosopher and parapsychologist Dr. Stephen Browdy asserts. By the way, as an aside, we talk about the problem with conceptualizing memory as being stored in the brain as this trace memory or this infinite regress problem. But the other way to approach it is through near-death experience science. And whether you opt for Dr. Brody's super psi idea, which I don't think holds up very well, but whether you opt for that or whether you opt for any other understanding of near-death experience science, that science completely undermines, blows apart this idea of memory stored in the brain, because, of course, you have this severely compromised brain, this brain that shouldn't be able to form memories the way that we say memories are formed and stored, and yet those memories are formed and stored if you buy into that model. So, just one more thing to throw on the pile there. Do let me hear from you. Do let me know how you think the show went for you, what you thought about it. The place to do it is through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. And from there, you can jump onto the forum or leave a comment right there or reach me via email or Facebook, any way you want. Please connect with me, connect with the show. Tell other people about it. Subscribe to it. Download any of the 300 shows. I'm glad that you're here, glad that you found it, and I hope you find it useful. I do have a number of interesting shows coming up, and I hope you stay with me for all of that. Until next time, take care, and bye for now.